From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Iraq crisis, anger and threats over Ukraine's ceasefire proposal, rainy season and its effect on South Sudan refugees, plus World Cup fans camping out along Brazil's beaches. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. AFP is reporting that Sunni militants in Iraq have taken control of one of Saddam Hussein's former chemical weapons factories. The complex, located 72 kilometers northwest of Baghdad, began producing mustard gas and other nerve agents, including sarin, in the early 1980s, soon after Saddam took power, according to a CIA fact sheet. The CIA writes that the facility shut down after the first Gulf War. Meantime, here in Washington on Thursday, President Obama said that he's sending 300 U.S. military advisors to Iraq to help that government fight the Islamist insurgents. The story now from VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez.
President Obama has been under pressure to respond to the advances made by militants who last week came dangerously close to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. On Thursday, the president outlined the steps the administration is taking to support Iraqi security forces.
We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward.
The teams are special operators whose first job will be to assess Iraq's security forces. Officials say scores of them will be arriving in Baghdad soon. The troops are already at bases in the general region. President Obama says the United States will intensify its intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance support for the Iraqis. Retired U.S. Army General Jack Keane says Iraq urgently needs an intelligence apparatus like the one U.S. forces had in place before they pulled out of Iraq in 2011.
And we would download all of our national theater and local intelligence systems so we have true situational awareness. Military term that tells you what is the enemy doing, where is the enemy, who, what, when, where. And we need that. When we pulled out of there in 2011, that screen for Maliki went blank. We took all that capability with us, never left any of it there for him. We have to put that back.
The president said targeted military action is possible in the future, but he emphasized that this is not another open-ended commitment of U.S. forces in Iraq.
American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well.
President Obama called on the leadership of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to govern with a more inclusive agenda in order to prevent Iraq from descending into an all-out civil war. The president said it is not up to America to decide who Iraq's leaders should be. The 300 advisors will be in addition to the 275 troops the president has committed to help safeguard the American embassy and other U.S. interests in the country. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Sunni refugees from northern Iraqi towns overrun by jihadists and other militants say they are afraid to return because of Iraqi Air Force bombing runs and the threats of U.S. airstrikes. Jamie Detmer has more from Erbil in northern Iraq.
Hundreds of thousands of Sunni Muslims have fled Mosul and other northern Iraq towns captured by fighters from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant and other militants. Seeking some relief from the scorching sun, baking a refugee camp an hour from Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan, Shaba, a grandmother of four, explains why she's not ready to return to Mosul, and it has nothing to do with the jihadists. Sitting in a blue UN refugee tent she's sharing with family members, she says she has already lost one son to an aerial bombardment. She worries about airstrikes and what Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will do to retake Mosul. She says she will not risk any other family members by going back home hastily. On Wednesday, Iraq's military claimed it had driven back Islamist militants from some towns, and Prime Minister al-Maliki struck a confident note in his weekly televised address, saying the fight back had begun. Much of the fight is being led by airstrikes, and there have been reports of bombing raids on Tikrit, the hometown of the late dictator Saddam Hussein. But Sunni refugees are not alone in worrying about the consequences of aerial bombardment. Turkey's Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan warned Thursday against airstrikes. He said air raids would inevitably lead to high civilian casualties because ISIL fighters and their Sunni militant allies are mixed in with civilians. A refugee with seven children says the family left because they feared shelling and airstrikes. Others in the camp say it was the immediate fighting that prompted them to flee. 18-year-old Masoud left Mosul with a sister and brother because of fighting and explosions. He says the situation was getting worse and bodies were laying in the street. He says they have no plans to return because of the jihadists and their fear of being bombed by Iraqi warplanes. The Iraqi government has formally asked the United States for help and is requesting tactical airstrikes, but Obama administration officials have signalled their reluctance to use air power to assist the Iraqi military as it tries to reclaim territory seized in recent weeks by ISIL fighters and other insurgents, arguing such an action will be filled with complications. Army General Martin E. Dempsey, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, told a U.S. Senate committee identifying clear targets would be difficult with Sunni insurgents living close by local populations. But the United States has been helping with intelligence and surveillance. Kurdish commanders, who are determined to keep jihadists from invading any of Iraqi Kurdistan, say U.S. drones have been flying and the information is being shared. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Erbil, Iraq.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Separatists in eastern Ukraine have rejected the government's offer of a unilateral ceasefire, and angry citizens in the streets of Kiev have also given the idea a thumbs down. Many in the capital say they didn't stand for days in the bitter cold earlier this year to topple the former Russia-friendly president, only for their new president to pander to Russian aggression. While Petro Poroshenko's peace plan has won the approval of France and Germany, it puts him in the dangerous position of alienating his support base just weeks into office and in a nation with a history of ousting unpopular leaders. VOA's Anita Powell is in Kiev with our report.
No one was surprised when pro-Russian fighters in eastern Ukraine, known for their brutal guerrilla tactics, automatically rejected the new president's offer of a unilateral ceasefire in return for the rebels putting down their arms or leaving the country. Such a deal, President Petro Poroshenko said, would bring an end to the conflict that has ravaged eastern Ukraine since the country's pro-Russian president was toppled in February following violent confrontations between anti-government demonstrators and security forces. But in Ukraine's capital, which has seen peaceful demonstrations nearly every day for the past 3 months, some of the protesters say they're hopping mad over the prosecution of the military campaign against the separatists and the new president's willingness to lay down arms. As Kiev's new city council prepared to hold its first session Thursday, the top city official was loudly harangued in the foyer by residents over the poor state of preparedness for Ukrainian troops. A group of wives and mothers in Kiev say they want their men brought home immediately because they're outgunned and unprepared. The woman, clearly upset, says her son told her, "We have no bullets to shoot. We will not survive one more night. Mom, do something." The official, Volodymyr Bondarenko, sympathizes, saying, "It's a crime. I promise I will demand," but she cuts him off. At this point, a man in the group demands that Bondarenko swear it. Promise. The woman, Irina Labun, 53, said she has two sons, Alexander and Dmitry, deployed as soldiers in eastern Ukraine. There is no ceasing fire, she says. We have only a ceasefire from one side, our side. Our boys don't have the right to shoot. and the militants, she said, are shooting at them. In the Maidan, the main Kiev square that was the epicenter of February's protests, this man, who gave his name only as Taras, says he thinks a ceasefire is a bad idea. Ukraine's government calls the military campaign against the separatists an anti-terrorist operation and refers to the militants as terrorists. You don't negotiate with terrorists, he says.
I think it's a very bad proposition. Terrorists don't speak. With terrorists, don't speak.
Another protester who gave his name only as Ali hinted at trouble for Mr. Poroshenko. Ali, with his camouflage uniform, bandit-style headscarf, full beard, and guerrilla superstar sunglasses, is among the legions of Ukrainian self-defense forces in the capital who protected protesters against riot police. If Poroshenko goes against us, he says, we will attack. This cycle of instability and conflict is all too familiar to another Maidan protester, Vladimir, who said he served as a young Soviet soldier in Afghanistan. He says he understands the humanitarian reasons for declaring a ceasefire. But he says his military experience more than two decades ago makes him cynical about a ceasefire. In theory, he says, the president is doing the right thing by the international community and the people. But from a military perspective, we fought in Afghanistan. We know what war is, and we know how it happens. This time will be used for regrouping, and it will be much harder to free this territory. At his inauguration more than a week ago, Mr. Poroshenko promised he would end conflict in the East within a week. Both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande support the ceasefire idea and have urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to accept the offer. But judging by the reactions of Mr. Poroshenko's base in Kiev, he is now fighting on more than one front, with a brewing political fight over his handling of the conflict. And in a nation where two of the last three leaders have been challenged by serious uprisings, that is a daunting prospect indeed. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kiev.
Also in the news, Kenyan officials say security forces have shot and killed five people suspected of involvement in deadly attacks that killed more than 60 people in a coastal town earlier this week. Kenyan Interior Ministry said the five suspects were killed while escaping in Lamu County, where the attacks took place. It said several guns and some ammunition were also recovered at the scene. Earlier this week, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta rejected claims that Somali militants were behind the attacks in and around the town of Mpeketoni. He said the attacks were well-planned, orchestrated, and politically motivated ethnic violence against the Kenyan community and accused local political networks of involvement. But Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for those attacks last Sunday. 50 people died then. 15 others died in a nearby village on Monday. South Sudan refugees have been crossing Ethiopia's border in large numbers since the start of the conflict there in December. And Marta Vanderwolf reports from Addis Ababa, the International Organization for Migration is concerned about the rainy season and its impact on the refugees.
About 1,500 South Sudan refugees come into Ethiopia every day, fleeing the violent conflict that has continued for 6 months. The International Organization for Migration assists the refugees from the border to the camps. An IOM spokesman, Alamayu Saifa Selassie, says because of the start of the rainy season, transporting the refugees is becoming more challenging.
The rainy season is coming and it's difficult because it affects the transport, it affects the road movement, and it's difficult because there is a large influx coming in every day, and moving them requires constant effort. We have over 40 buses that we are working with, and particularly on the roadside, it gets to be a bit more difficult.
Fighting broke out in December in South Sudan after a political rift between President Salva Kiir and his former vice president, Riek Machar. More than 1.5 million people have been displaced within the country, but many also fled to neighboring countries Kenya, Uganda, and Ethiopia. More than 147,000 South Sudanese are in Ethiopia's southwestern province of Gambela. Once refugees cross the border, they are registered by UNHCR and transported by IOM to the refugee camps. The camps are another one-day drive or 10-hour boat trip away. The rising water level is not affecting transporting refugees by boat, but the rain is affecting road transportation. Alamayo says the rain will continue for the next months.
So as the water level is rising and as roads are being in need of repairs, that will create a bit of a difficulty transporting the refugees to the camps because the road was not good and it was under maintenance. So as the road was under construction, we had to use the boats. That was a bit challenging. Mm-hmm. The rain has made the transportation a bit difficult.
There are four refugee camps in Gambela. Two have been built high enough and will not be affected by the rainy season. The other two camps might be affected. The number of South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia is expected to increase to 350,000 by the end of the year. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Nigeria's state oil company says India has overtaken the United States as the biggest importer of Nigerian crude. Statement Thursday says the U.S. has drastically reduced imports to 250,000 barrels a day. Says India is importing one-third of Nigeria's daily output of 2.5 million barrels, closely followed by China and Malaysia. U.S. boom in domestic shale oil production is behind the shift.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
More than 50,000 children, most without adult companions, have crossed illegally in the United States from Mexico in recent weeks. For the most part, they are from Central American nations experiencing gang violence. Influxes overwhelmed U.S. Border Patrol agents and the facilities along the Texas border area that are set up to house the detainees. VOA's Greg Flakus has our report.
Hundreds of undocumented immigrant children are being held in detention centers near the border, and many more have been sent to a special center established in Arizona. Normally, Mexican citizens who are caught crossing the border illegally are returned fairly quickly, and people from other countries are processed through the immigration court system. By law, however, children cannot be sent back alone and must be processed through the Office of Refugee Resettlement or put in the care of family members residing in the United States. That normal flow of administrative processing is in a logjam now because so many children are in custody. Border Patrol agents and immigration officials at the border are frustrated by the situation but have been told not to speak to the news media. Sean Moran is vice president of the National Border Patrol Council. He says what agents are encountering along the Rio Grande River border with Mexico these days is very unusual.
Most times people that are crossing the border illegally attempt to evade the Border Patrol. They do not seek them out unless they're injured. But in these cases, Border Patrol agents are actively being sought out. People are just waiting in very conspicuous areas to be apprehended by the Border Patrol.
The White House says families in violence-torn countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are sending their children north to protect them. Moran says that seemed to be the case at first, but that now many of the detainees say they came for another reason.
Our interviews with the detainees show that overwhelmingly now they are coming because they heard from a family member or a friend that the U.S. is not enforcing its immigration laws and that the U.S. was handing out what they term permisos or permits and allowing people to stay here in the U.S.
Moran says Border Patrol agents have seen intelligence that leads them to believe the border crossings are being orchestrated by the criminal gangs called cartels that engage in both drug smuggling and human trafficking.
We believe this is a coordinated activity by the cartels to tie up Border Patrol agents so that they can push their drugs through.
Tristan Reed, Mexico security analyst for Austin, Texas-based Stratfor, a global intelligence firm, says Mexican drug cartels very well could be taking advantage of the Central American immigrants since they control border crossings from the Mexican side.
It is well within their ability to pick and choose who crosses and where they cross. And it's certainly a good opportunity for them to push, you know, much more profitable drugs across the border while law enforcement is distracted.
But Reed says this is not what is causing the increased flow of immigrants, both adults and children, from Central America. He says crime and insecurity in those countries have created conditions not unlike those found in war-ravaged nations. But though it may not be an orchestrated effort on the part of any crime organization, Reed says the drug trade is largely to blame for people leaving.
They are escaping from legitimate drug wars that are going on in their cities or their municipalities. As drugs flow, that's money to be had for criminals. And especially when you start bringing in organized and very capable Mexican crime groups into Central America, it sort of helps organize and fuel these drug wars even more.
Tristan Reed says poverty and lack of economic opportunity also play a role and help answer why parents in those countries would send their children alone on the long journey across Mexico so that they can cross into the United States. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
Thousands of football fans are camping out in Brazil during the month-long World Cup, and many of them living out of their cars and campers along Rio de Janeiro's famed beaches. VOA's Scott Bob has our report.
Copacabana's Avenue of the Americas. These fans from Argentina are preparing for the day's games. They drove for 3 days from their home in Cordoba, 3,000 kilometers away, in order to be part of the World Cup. They live out of this delivery truck in one of Rio's most sought-after parking areas. Guillermo Juri is one of them. We had to wait a couple of hours, then we got lucky. The spot became available, so we parked here, facing the beach, just meters from the fan fest. We are very comfortable. Thousands of fans are choosing to rough it in vehicles that range from the luxurious to the utilitarian, and even historic. Why? So they can afford tickets to the games, which cost hundreds of dollars. Lucas Valinotti heats water with his car's cigarette lighter. The food is basic, but no Argentine will forego his daily mate, the herb-infused tea that is the national drink. He says he will never forget this experience.
We are really enjoying it. You hear 20, 30, 40 different languages at the same time. I've met people that I would have never met in my life, and I took pictures with some crazy ones. This is great.
They sleep anywhere they can. Franco Jofre from Buenos Aires says he and his two friends squeeze into his compact when it rains. Otherwise, they sleep on the sidewalk. Jofre says they bathe in the public bathrooms. The main problem is that there are only 30 toilets for thousands of fans who gather here. But no one seems to mind.
Everywhere is happy, everywhere wants to chat to other people, meet new people. It's just great. It's the World Cup, you know? And it's an amazing event, just the biggest event on our time of history, you know?
Some illegally parked vehicles have been fined or towed. But for these fans, it's worth it. Others pay hundreds of dollars a night for hotel rooms with this view. Here, the view is free, even though it's curbside. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
And at the World Cup on Thursday, in Group C, Colombia had a 2-1 victory over Ivory Coast. In Group D, it was Uruguay beating England 2-1. In Group C, Greece and Japan tied nil all. Later today, Italy plays Costa Rica in Group D, and in Group E, it'll be Switzerland up against France, plus Honduras and Ecuador, and all 64 matches will be played by the time the final match takes place on July 13th. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to The Voice of America today and for International Edition. You might have also found us on the Internet at voanews.com. We're always there. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1782, Congress adopted the Great Seal of the United States, an official symbol that appears on international treaties and certain government documents. The seal depicts a bald eagle clutching an olive branch and arrows. In 1789, in Versailles, the deputies of the French Third Estate, representing the common people and the lower clergy, met on a tennis court and took an oath demanding a new constitution. It was one of the events leading to the French Revolution. In 1837, Victoria became Queen of the United Kingdom. The 18-year-old queen began the longest reign of any British monarch. In 1863, the breakaway state of West Virginia was admitted to the Union in the midst of the Civil War. Mostly small farmers with no slaves, a majority of Western Virginians opposed Virginia's secession in 1861. On this day in 1900, Chinese nationalists fighting increasing foreign encroachment during the so-called Boxer Rebellion besieged the diplomatic quarter in the capital, Peking. It would take weeks for an international relief force to be assembled and break the siege. On this day in 1919, the German cabinet deadlocked over whether to accept the peace terms presented to its delegation at the Versailles Peace Conference in Paris, France. The Germans, who had been counting on the approval of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's proposals of a peace without victory, were disillusioned by the harsh treaty that eventually emerged. Germany was asked to lose 13% of its territory and 10% of its population, pay reparations, and accept the blame for the war. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The key suspect in the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, has been captured by U.S. special forces. Ahmed Abu Qatala will now face the full weight of the U.S. justice system. The arrest of Ahmed Abu Qatala, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, is a clear reminder to anyone who seeks to harm the United States that they will be brought to justice. Four Americans were killed on the night of September 11, 2012, when armed assailants attacked the U.S. special mission in Benghazi, Libya. Four American personnel, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, were killed in the violence. It was the first time since 1979 that a U.S. ambassador was killed in the line of duty. The United States, which captured Qatala unilaterally, continues to work through its embassy in Tripoli with Libya's democratically elected institutions to advance shared interests, including establishing rule of law and stability throughout the country. The United States stood by the Libyan people 3 years ago as they rose up against the tyrant Muammar Gaddafi. The United States continues to support them in their desire to build democratic institutions that will provide them with security, protect their universal rights, and help rebuild their economy. In an official statement, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said the vision of a peaceful and productive new nation will guide Libya's future, and they have a friend in the United States as they pursue that vision. We will remain vigilant against all acts of terrorism, said President Barack Obama in an official statement. We will also sustain our support for the Libyan people as they work to overcome years of tyranny and do the difficult work of building a democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.